We are taking a walk on the paranormal side tonight with Paul Kimball, author of The Other Side of Truth. We're going to get into ghosts and some other areas in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Kimball with us. Paul, your uncle, of course, Stanton Friedman, has always believed that these UFOs and extraterrestrials are coming from physical realities, other planetary systems. Are you 100% there?
No. And I don't think he is either. That's sort of what he's presented over the years, and that there's no question that that's generally speaking what he believes.
Yeah. But
when you talk to him in person, when you get to know him, he's much more open-minded about the possibilities than that might seem to be. So, for instance, I've heard him say that he doesn't know whether they're from other planets within our own universe, or they could be from alternate dimensions, which moves him not completely, you know, divorced from Jacques Vallée's idea that we might be dealing with people from beings from other dimensions. And then you're into the whole, well, it's a distinction without a difference. So as he got older, and he's still getting older, thank goodness, I've actually heard Stan say more and more that it doesn't, and I'm paraphrasing here, he might correct me on the phrasing, it doesn't necessarily matter so much where they're from. What matters is they're here.
Yeah.
Now, he thinks that they're here in physical craft of some sort. So he would say it doesn't matter if it comes from a planet in our universe or it comes from another dimension or they're time travelers, but they're here in a physical way. So that's where he and I sort of part ways. He takes that as an absolute proven fact, and I say, well, I don't think you can prove that. I don't think that's a proven fact. I'm with you right up to the point that I think we're dealing with something that isn't us. But it could be from here. It could be God. It could, or what we've traditionally called God. It could be aliens from another planet. Could be from another dimension. I don't know. But I don't think that they're here in sort of 1950s nuts and bolts spacecraft that look like something out of a War of the Worlds production. And so that's where he and I would differ. I sort of go more towards or fall more in line with what Vallée's thinking is, which is it's intrinsically weirder and more mysterious and interesting than just, you know, that nuts and bolts spacecraft stuff. Having said that, it's entirely possible that Stan's right, that they could be nuts and bolts spacecraft. I certainly don't rule it out, because when you look at the technological change, I attended, in 2009, I attended a lecture in London. Holly and I, when we finished shooting Ghost Cases, we toured around the United Kingdom and Europe for 3 weeks because we were there. So, you know, if you're there, you might as well tour around. And Michio Kaku, who I know has been on your show many times. And I'm a big fan of his work. So he was speaking at the RSA in London on his new book, which I think was The Physics of the Impossible. So there we are, these two people in London. And instead of doing all this other cool stuff that we could have done, we went to see a lecture on The Physics of the Impossible, which, you know, how geeky am I? And how geeky is Holly? But as we're there, there was a Q&A at the end of it. And I had read his book. I was one of the few people, I'm pretty sure, in the audience who had actually read his book, which I think he appreciated when I asked my question. And so my question was, you know, Dr. Kaku, you talk in your book about a galactic conversation that is probably going on between all these advanced civilizations out there. And I could hear, as I said it, I could hear the, you know, sort of the twitters, the laughter in the audience, people giggling, kind of thing. Oh, God, he's going to start talking about aliens or something. Who let this guy in? And I said, well, how long do you think it's going to be before we might be able to tune in to that conversation? And a couple other people asked questions. And Kaku went directly to mine first. And I think, A, because he appreciated that I had read his book and knew what he was talking about. But B, he found it more interesting, which I think shocked some people in the audience. He really sort of went off at length about this. And he said, yeah, absolutely. I think there is life in the galaxy. I think there's more advanced, some of it's more advanced than us, and that there is this conversation going on. But then he answered my question by saying, we're not going to be able to tune into it anytime soon in our life. And he used the analogy of humans and ants. He said, imagine we're ants. That's who we are. And these galactic beings are building, you know, 10-lane superhighways next to us. Well, the ant doesn't really understand what the superhighway is about, and the humans who are building the superhighway don't really look down at the ants. And he talks about how a galactic civilization would be more than a million years advanced than us, and everything about them would be so far beyond where we are that we wouldn't even be able to comprehend understanding them, and they wouldn't even deign to notice us. So as I walked out, I kind of thought to myself, well, okay, that could be true. That generally reflects the consensus of the scientific community that they might be out there, but if they are more advanced, they're so much more advanced, we couldn't communicate with them. But then I read his book, And he actually, and some of his writings, and he describes a number of different types of civilization. And one of them is a type one civilization. He puts them in generally, I think, three categories, which is a planetary society capable of travel within their own solar system and perhaps even limited interstellar missions. So maybe we could get to the Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system. And he writes that that could be achieved in as little as a century, although probably longer, but maybe within 100 years. Then he talks about a type two civilization, which would be capable of interstellar flight within our own local region. I'm starting to sound a lot like Stan now. Within our own galactic neighborhood, which might only be 800 years or so beyond where we are now. Now, that seems like an awful long time to us sitting here, but 800 years is a drop in the bucket in sort of the interstellar galactic time, you know, however long the universe has been around. 800 years is nothing. And I think what you have to do is, and I sort of mentioned this to him afterwards when I went up and spoke to him and he signed my book, you know, you kind of have to take a historical perspective on this, which he took in good stride. If you went back in time to 1865 at the end of the American Civil War, and you found somebody, say Ulysses Grant or Abe Lincoln before he was shot, and said, here's what's going to happen within 100 years. Your country, the United States, will possess bombs that will be able to obliterate entire cities, launched not by artillery or cannons, but by flying machines that can travel several times the speed of sound, you know, across the oceans in 4 or 5 hours, all while men walk on the moon, which we don't do anymore, but we have done in the past. They would have locked you up in a rubber room. They would have said you're crazy. But that all came to pass. So within 100 years, we created this entirely new world that you could, only the wildest imaginations in 1865 would have been able to imagine.
Except Da Vinci. He might have known about it.
He might have known about it, but very, 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 very few people. H.G. Wells, for instance, you know, science fiction authors are always imagining this stuff, and most often they're the ones who will say, like Isaac Asimov, well, it's not real. This will never happen, but we can imagine it. I say, well, if you can imagine it, then it's entirely possible that it could happen. And a lot of the things that people have imagined in the past, science fiction authors in particular, have eventually, just look at Star Trek, things that they were doing in the 60s, were now more advanced. You know, Captain Kirk's communicator, we all carry them. They're called cell phones, or as my British friends would say, mobile phones. And they're actually more advanced than the ones that Captain Kirk was carrying, and they're smaller, and, you know, they fit into your pocket. So that kind of technology that Gene Roddenberry and his guys were imagining in the 60s, we have now. And we're moving faster and further beyond it at an accelerating rate. That's the interesting thing. If you were to go, Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon, the army that he led in 49, I think it was 49 BC, looked pretty much the same as the army that the Romans would have had at the fall of the Roman Empire in 476. So 500 years. Nothing much had changed in terms of military technology. Take a look at our own century. In 1914, The Royal Navy was the greatest navy on the planet Earth. It had enforced the Pax Britannica for 100 years. And the German Navy was close behind. They fought this battle in 1916 at Jutland, this great battle between fleets of battleships. 40 years later, if you could again travel back in time, just 40 years later, one ship, a nuclear-powered submarine with nuclear weapons, could have destroyed both fleets with one nuclear weapon.
That's right.
And the sailors who would have seen this happen on the decks of these ships, these great battleships that were the height of human technology in 1914, 1916, all they would have seen would be this blinding flash of light and then the shock wave that would have obliterated both fleets. And their last thought, I'm pretty sure, as they were about to die, would have been, where the heck did this come from? You know, this is the wrath of God. But they wouldn't have seen where it came from because the submarine would have fired it from under the water. They wouldn't have seen the missile. All they would have seen would be this flashlight, and then it would be over. That's 40 years. So when we think about the ant and the human analogy that Dr. Kaku was talking about, and we get back to the idea of interstellar flight and could aliens be coming here, I mean, absolutely. Because even if they are, just say, 800 years ahead of us, or even 500 years. Think of the technological advances that we've made in just the last 50 years, and then extrapolate that by a factor of 10 or 15 or 20, even if they're 1,000 years ahead of us. But they won't. That doesn't necessarily mean then that they're so far ahead of us that they would be like gods to our ants.
Well, and we always make the assumption, Paul, that they're nice. We can't.
Yes, we do. And that's an assumption, actually, that I make, because I kind of look at the evidence and I say, if they really wanted to do us harm, they could have done it by now. I go back to the nuclear submarine example. Let's assume that we're not even Jutland. We're like pirates in the 15th century in sailing ships were Columbus coming across the ocean. And we're talking about they would have the technology of, say, a nuclear submarine. Well, if you took one nuclear submarine back to the 15th century, you could have conquered the entire world. So if the aliens, or whatever they are, have this kind of technology, they would, you know, you see these movies where the plucky humans fight back against the alien invaders, which makes for, you know, an amusing movie. But it's absolutely ridiculous in terms of reality. If you were to imagine an alien civilization that could get from here, from there to here, coming here, their technology, we wouldn't be shooting them down. They wouldn't, there's nothing that we could do to stop that. I mean, the technological divide, even if it was only 500 years, would be so far difference between us and them that there's nothing we could do, any more than there would be anything that people in the 16th century could do if we could travel back in time with nuclear weapons and machine guns and drones and all that sort of stuff that we have now and say, hey, you know, try and fight against this. So I kind of look at that and I say, if they wanted to hurt us, they could, but they haven't. They haven't taken over the planet. They haven't destroyed us. So that means to me they're either, they don't care, they're just sort of benign neglect.
Or they're not ready. Maybe they're not ready yet. They're slow. They're methodical.
They could be. But again, like I said, with the technology that they would possess or the abilities that they would possess, I don't think that they would have to have the kind of troop buildup that, say, Montgomery had at El Alamein to beat Rommel. I mean, we're just dealing with a level of technology or of advancement on some level that if they really wanted to, they could have made short work of us.
We couldn't touch it.
Yeah. So to me, that means that, and I'm, you know, I might be wrong. Like I said, only questions, no answers. But this one I'm pretty close to an answer on. I would say, well, okay, I don't think it's possible that they would be here to do us harm because they would have done it by now. Benign neglect doesn't make sense to me because they seem to interact with us on such a regular basis that transcends just benign neglect. So that leaves me with one possible alternative, which is they're actually here to, I won't say help us, but I will say help us. it's the sort of the best thing that I can think of, that they're here to actually help us in certain ways to, as I said before, to encourage us to think, to imagine a world beyond us. And sometimes that can be pretty scary. I talk, and people would say, well, wait, okay, you had these ghost experiences and you were afraid, right? And I'd say, yeah, absolutely, I was afraid. In the same way, well, then why would anybody who doesn't want to hurt you actually scare you like that? And I would say, well, I don't know. Why do filmmakers make films like The Blair Witch Project or Paranormal Activity? And then why do we willingly walk into those films knowing that they're going to scare us? It's because fear is a powerful motivating factor. It's one of those human emotions that I think that they would want to trigger in us to make us feel more alive. So sure, I don't, when I was doing the ghost stuff, there were a number of occasions, and then we can talk about them if you want, where I was really afraid. I have no problem admitting.
Did you walk in that way?
Yeah, I've always had a healthy respect for things like that. But no, you know, I wasn't prepared for at least a couple of the things that happened to me. And so when they did happen, you know, you find out a lot about who you are. In those moments, there was one in particular where we were in a allegedly haunted house out in a rural area. There was nothing else around here in Nova Scotia. And Holly and a psychic, we actually had brought a psychic in for that episode. In fact, this clip is on your website because I sent it in. So it's one of the clips they put up. And they're upstairs doing this seance or automatic reading and trying to contact the spirits or whatever. And in I decided I'd go downstairs. So they're up with the camera crew. Everyone's upstairs. I go down into this creepy root cellar basement, and anyone who's ever been in a farm knows what these things are like. And there's nobody else there. It's freezing cold. I take a small digital video camera. I point it at myself, and then I just sit on the stairs, and I say, look, I'm going to come down here, because it was supposed to be the most haunted area, and I'm going to see if anything happens. And what happens is I can hear them through the floorboards, sort of, and I hear things drifting down, and I hear them talk about baby, dead baby, you know, talk to Paul. What? Talk to Paul. He's in the basement. Well, that's where the baby is. And I go, no, no, you actually see me in the show going, don't send, you know, any spirits down here. I don't want anything to happen. Go away. And then something does happen. The door behind me, which leads into the root cellar, which was closed, which hadn't even moved in the hour that I had been down there, suddenly swings open. Literally at the exact time that they're doing this. I said, go down and show Paul, you know, say hello to him or whatever, and then the door goes. I you know, I left. I thought the crew was playing a joke on me at first. Turns out they weren't. So I'm standing out there. I'm looking at this open door. I'm listening to them talking about contacting this spirit and going to come down and talk to me. And then the door opens. There's nobody around. There's no other houses. There's nothing that could have done this. There was no wind. The door was, it was wedged in, too. It was kind of like against the dirt. It was a very hard door to open if you were outside, opening it from the outside. You actually had to pull it. And this thing had just, boom, out. Open. So yeah, I have no problem admitting I can't explain that, and it scared me. And then looking at it in hindsight, we also had audio recorders, digital audio recorders, at about the same time as all this was happening. And you can hear that on the clip that's on your site. You can sort of see and hear this. We reviewed the audio later, and there's what sounds like a baby, the voice of a small child or a baby.
Little children always seem to come through on those things, don't they?
Yeah, but what do I do with that? At the end of the day, was there really a dead baby in the basement, the spirit of the dead baby, or was this some sort of advanced non-human intelligence's version of the Blair Witch Project?
Yeah.
And I was the audience.
And you were the, yeah, that's right, you, you and were the experiment.
The intention that they had was to partly to see what I do. And like any filmmaker, you know, filmmakers, musicians, Bruce Springsteen talks about this a lot, the thrill of performing. So, you know, maybe they're getting something out of it too. Again, that aspect of co-creation. But most importantly, to impart on me this understanding or this awareness that there might be something more than just me. You know, there might be another world out there. There might be other lives. There might be other beings out there. And I can tell you, because I waited 40 minutes, a good professional that I am, they were still filming inside, so I didn't want to run inside and break up the filming.
Spoil that, yeah.
So I stood outside in the freezing cold. I've heard you talk about cold tonight. It was probably minus 15 centigrade here in Canada. It was freezing. But I stood outside in the snow and the cold with my own thoughts. I wouldn't go back in the basement, but with nothing but my thoughts. And if that was what happened to me, if there was an advanced non-human intelligence trying to get me to think, it succeeded. Mission accomplished, because I spent 40 minutes basically having a conversation with myself about what the heck just happened and what does that mean. And it kind of, that and a number of other experiences, shadow people in the Czech Republic, which was a weird one that maybe we can talk about or get into.
Yeah, well, let's do that after the break. That's
sure. Those are the kinds of things that when they happen to you, you just kind of go, and then one after another. And I kind of view it as by doing this, by getting into the ghost investigating thing. I talk about this in the book.
You like that. Sounds like you like that a lot.
I did. I had a great time. But like I did when I saw the Blair Witch Project, even though it scared the heck out of me. But I had never really done anything like that before. I had been talking to people who had done things like that. And I think it's kind of like a movie. You have to buy a ticket. So when I actually went out and started doing it myself, that was like me buying a ticket to go in and see the movie. And we can all do it. Anybody can go see a movie. But if you don't go buy a ticket, you're not actually going to see the new movie. Well, that was the first time that I had really bought a ticket. And I think that's when they started, you know, running the projector and saying, look, okay, great. Here's the film. At least the film that we're going to show you this time, because this is what you were expecting to see. And that's what we got, night after night after night, you know, a very interesting, weird sort of horror film, which looking back on it was fun.
Paul, when we come back, we're going to talk about the shadow person experience that you had. Paul Kimball's our guest. His website, redstarfilmtv.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Paul Kimball as we talk about the other side of truth, the paranormal, the art of imagination, the human condition. More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Paul Kimball with us. Paul, let's talk a little bit about this shadow person experience you had in the Czech Republic. What were you doing there, first of all?
Well, it gets back to the one of the fringe benefits of being a television director, producer, host, whatever, is you can build in personal trips when you're on the road if you've got a professional trip. So we were in the United Kingdom filming the last four episodes of Ghost Cases, and seeing how we were there, we already had a one-way ticket going over. Holly and I decided to take, because it was the end of the shoot for us. We'd been doing this for about 8 months on and off. I won't say it was stressful. It's always fun. But, you know, it was hard work, and it's sort of emotionally draining dealing with a lot of these things like the baby in the basement that I was talking about. So we said, look, we're in Europe. Let's take 3 weeks, and we took a vacation in England, which is where I saw Kaku, Scotland, which I went to school in Scotland when I was younger, so it was nice to go back. And then we just sort of spun the dial and said, Continental Europe. I've never been on the continent. I want to go. So it was either Romania, which I thought would be cool, Dracula's castle, Greece, which I also thought would be cool, or the Czech Republic. I knew a lot of people who had been there. And the Czech Republic turned out to be the cheapest option. So off we went. We went to the, spent 8 days, 7 days, sorry, in Prague, which was wonderful. And then we spent 3 days in this little town. Well, it's actually not that little. It's sort of a mid-sized town in the southern Czech Republic called Český Krumlov, which is a World Heritage Site. It's got the second largest castle after Prague in the country. This tremendous old town from sort of medieval days. So you've got these winding streets and everything. It's one of those towns that the communists didn't manage to completely destroy when they ran the country for 60 some odd years. So most of the old, in fact, all of the old town is still intact. So it's this beautiful town. So that's why we were there, simply on vacation. When we got there, I had booked us into this inn, which is I call it a wizard's castle. It's a tower. It's this little tower, and it looks like a wizard's castle, something out of Lord of the Rings. And so I said, well, if you're going to be in this really cool old town, why wouldn't you stay in a wizard's castle? So we'll do that. Unfortunately, the wizard's castle had changed ownership between the time I'd done the booking and when we actually arrived. So the new guy had messed up the reservations. And he had put us in a room with only one bed. Now, Holly and I were not a couple. She had a boyfriend at the time. So we were friends, very good friends, mm-hmm. and co-hosts. But we were always in different beds and, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. I can't stress that enough for her new boyfriend. So the guy said, well, look, you know, you can go into town or find another place, or I can get you, these people are leaving tomorrow and you can have your room tomorrow. And I said, look, I'm tired. It's not really your fault. I'll sleep on the floor. And so we kind of went and had dinner and everything and got back to the room around 11 o'clock that night. And I realized that the floor was like sort of the bed on a Klingon battle cruiser. The thing about wizard's castles are the floors, that, you know, you're not sleeping on carpet, or it's sort of a stone floor. So as I'm lying there on the floor, Holly's up in the bed going, you know, look, you can come up and sleep here. I said, no, I'm a gentleman. I'm not going to do that. My hay fever was acting up. This is sort of like the long lead into what is hopefully an interesting story. I said, I'm going for a walk. It's Monday night. And she said, do you want me to come with you? I said, no. How much trouble can I get into on a Monday night in early June in Český Krumlov? I'm sure I'll be fine. So she said, fine. So as soon as I get out, the fresh air cleared my sinuses, so I wasn't having hay fever problems anymore. And I kind of took this meandering walk into Old Town because we were about a 10 to 15 minute walk away. And to get there, you had to cross over this bridge, which is sort of important, over the Vltava River. And on the bridge, you can look directly up to the castle, you can see there's all these statues, including one of Jesus. So anyway, I cross the bridge, and I'm playing this game with myself. And here's the thing about, we were talking about buying a ticket, you know, sort of indicating to whatever might be out there, hey, I want to see the movie. So there's a game I played with myself for years and years where, because the Halifax Commons, it's sort of this circular thing like the Boston Commons, and I walk around it because it's near my house. It's where I get my exercise. So when I'm at one end of the Commons, I will imagine myself at the other end of the Commons and say, okay, now keep that image in my mind. And then when I get to the other end of the Commons, I look back to where I was before. And it's sort of like time travel. I'm trying to imagine myself in two different places. And it sort of always kind of freaks me out. So I did it that night. When I started to cross the bridge, I imagined myself at the other end of the bridge, and I got there and I went, oh, okay. And then I sort of could imagine myself where I had just been, and I started pondering, you know, fate, time, occasion, chance, all that sort of stuff. And again, thinking about all the weird things that had happened to me and Holly over the previous 7 or 8 months. So I get into the town square, I continue on, and I sit down. There's nobody there. Like, the town's deserted. It's completely deserted. Everyone's in bed or whatever. And as I'm sitting there, just kind of, you know, taking it all in, it's a really large square. I see out of the corner of my eye what I think is a person. Now, when you're in a strange town, I'm sure you would know this, most of your listeners would, if you haven't been there before, you're not afraid, but you keep an eye out when you see other people, especially at night, approaching you.
Right. You know, you're not familiar with the scenario, I think.
Exactly. A lesson I learned more than once in Los Angeles. So, you know, and in my own hometown too. So I see what is out of the corner of my eye seems like a person. And I kind of look, and I can't make it out. It's a shadow. But it's not against a wall. It's kind of coming through the center of the square. And I just kind of look away for a second. I think, oh, okay. So, and then I look back. I should have another look at this guy. And he's gone, or it's gone. There's nothing. I'm alone again. So I'm sitting there, and I go, well, okay, that's a little weird. Where could that guy have gone? Because it was far. There's no way it could have gotten to any of the doors.
Just
the
disappeared.
Places. Yeah, exactly. And there's, you know, on my website or whatever, I put up photos and stuff. And in the book, actually, there's a photo of the town square where it's like, okay, here's where I was sitting on that bench, and here's sort of where that guy was, and where did he go? I don't know. So I wasn't completely freaked out, but I was a little unnerved. So I decided, you know, maybe it's time I headed back to the Wizard's Castle. And I start walking back towards the bridge. And earlier in the day, I noticed a toy store. I have three nephews and a niece. And I said, well, look, I want to be a good uncle. I'll take souvenirs back to them. So I stopped by the window of the toy store to kind of look in, thinking, okay, well, let me see what they've got. I'm just going to take a moment. Oh, there's a little, they're all handcrafted wooden toys. So little wooden mice and everything, really cool stuff. I actually did buy some of them. And this feeling comes over me, and I sort of look up into the window, and behind me, I see this shadow over my shoulder. Now, at that point, anybody who's ever been walking along, I was a police officer, as a Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
You've done it all.
Yeah, I spent a summer as a special constable in a really rough area of Nova Scotia, in Cape Breton. I learned enough. I'm a lover, not a fighter, but I did learn, you know, enough to how to sort of spin around and to be aware of your surroundings, as Obi-Wan Kenobi would say. Always be mindful of your surroundings. So I kind of spin around thinking, okay, there's somebody behind me. Am I going to get mugged or something? There's nobody there. Nothing. I look back into the window, which was functioning in effect as a mirror. Nothing. So there's nothing there. Okay, now I am genuinely bordering on scared. Certainly, you know, I kind of say, I'll deal with the toys tomorrow. Start heading back towards the Wizard's Castle, which means I have to go back over the bridge. As I get on the bridge and I'm walking across the bridge from behind, there's nobody else on the bridge. From behind me, I hear footsteps, which I'm not going to try and imitate now because I'm terrible at sound effects. Imagine what footsteps.
But you're a musician, for crying out loud.
I know. I would hire somebody to do the sound effects. Because, you know, clip-clop, that sounds like a horse. That's terrible. But it sounds, you know, like footsteps on a wooden bridge. I remember stopping, balling up my fist, and I had this real feeling of unease, too, about me as well. It's almost like, I won't say an out-of-body experience, but definitely queasy, definitely, you know, my nerves were heightened, all that sort of stuff. I stop, this footsteps stop. I turn around on a dime, prepared for, you know, like somebody's clearly following me, and I'm about to get mugged or something. Nobody there. And I'm standing right next, this is the weird part, I mentioned the statue of Jesus. I'm standing right next to the statue of Jesus when this happened on the bridge. Then I feel it on my shoulder. Speaking of police officers, it's that kind of feeling when a police officer would grab you, you know, sort of in movies, you'll see a hand come on your shoulder and say, excuse me, sir, or son, you need to come with me, sort of thing. And it's this feeling of something grasping my shoulder. So I spin around again, and there's nothing there. And I have absolutely, I describe the experience in more detail in the book, but I have absolutely no problem admitting to all of your listeners that I took off like a bat out of, you know, the proverbial underworld. I said, I'm a fraidy cat at heart. I'd had enough. And it was just that, you know, shadow in the square, shadow over my shoulder in that in the window of the toy store, and then that that feeling, those footsteps, and then that feeling on my shoulder. To this day, I can't explain that. I got back to the Wizard's Castle, and I went in, and I didn't tell Holly. She sort of woke up as I came in. She said, everything okay? I said, fine.
Would she have believed you had you told her?
Yeah. Absolutely, because we both, you know, we'd both been having these kind of conversations during the course of shooting ghost cases, where she would tell me something, and we'd come to respect each other's opinion. I mean, she's trained as a biologist. She's a wonderful actress, but her original training, she has a bachelor's degree in science and biology, so she's trained as a scientist. You know, I'm trained as a lawyer and a historian. We're serious people, and we went into the show, me in particular, saying, I don't want to make just another ghost show. I want to do more of a documentary show and really get into what the host, you know, the personal experience thing. So we took each other seriously, and she, I'm sure, would have taken me seriously, except I didn't tell her. In fact, I've still never told her in person. She's read about it because she's moved to the west coast of Canada now. So she lives out there and I live here. I haven't had the chance to talk to her about it in person since I published it. But I didn't want to tell her. I was so freaked out. And I have to admit, back then I was getting better, but I was still afraid sometimes. And your viewers will notice this in the clip that's on your website that I sent in. One of the two, the other one is not the baby in the basement, but this church cemetery we were in. I saw something, a lot of things freaky happened there, but the clip is about this thing I saw in the sky. I never would have told anybody about it, except my co-producer saw something similar in another part of the cemetery and came and told me about it. And then I had confirmation, right? So that's okay, well, I can tell you about my thing. But on my own, I was always very reticent to even to Holly to tell her that something weird had happened to me, because I was afraid of looking foolish or people making fun of me, even Holly making fun of me maybe, even though she never did. So I didn't tell her. I had never told her until I wrote about this first on my blog and then a more extensive version in the book. But the next day, so we get up and we tour the castle. And she says, "Is everything fine? You seem a little out of sorts." And I go, no, I'm just, sleeping on the floor. I'll my back.
Yeah.
I'll be fine.
We're all fine sleeping on the floor, aren't we?
Yeah. It's like Jean-Luc Picard trying to sleep on the Klingon battlecruiser. I remember that episode of Star Trek. But we get into town. I'm back by the toy store. We split up. She wanders off. She had seen something she wanted to buy for her mother. So we're trying to make the most use of our time. And I said, well, I'm going to go to the toy store and then this bookstore. Get to the toy store. And then I notice on the wall across from the toy store, down a little alley, there's this piece of graffiti, which I took a picture of it. It freaked me out. I put it in the book. And what it is it's this, which I hadn't noticed before. It's this eye with what looks to be arms coming out of it. And in this, it sort of looks like an eye. And in the center of it, where you would have the pupil, it almost looks like a shadowy shape of a person. And I thought, well,
no red eyes though, right?
Huh?
No red eyes or any look
no,
like
no,
that?
No, it was the graffiti was all in black.
Okay.
So it was all, somebody had done it with a black spray can or whatever. A nice little piece of art. Speaking of art, paranormal and art, here's a piece of graffiti. I'm thinking, do people in this town, does this happen, what happened to me, does that happen on a regular basis? And is this how they represent it or anything like that? And that's just, that kind of freaked me out. And we wound up later that night. It was our last night in town, and we were heading back home to Canada two days later. So we kind of had a blowout drink fest in a bar called the Horror Bar, which we thought was really cool.
Perfect name, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the basement, and you can drink on a coffin. So it was a really cool place.
As long as you don't end up in one.
Well, exactly. And the nice thing about it is I asked, if anyone's ever in Chesky Krumlov, go to the Horror Bar and ask somebody who's working there, what time do you close? And they say, whenever our last customer wants to leave, which I thought, this is the best bar I've ever been in.
Right.
But we just sort of sat there talking about all of our experiences. And I was really, I was running on adrenaline by this point. And I just couldn't bring myself to tell her about what had happened to me in that very town. So it's that kind of thing like Stan would talk about, the laughter curtain, when he talks to UFO audiences at lectures he gives. And that I experienced it very much myself, that sort of, you bought the ticket to get into the theater, but I don't want to go out and tell anybody how I felt about the movie because it disturbed me or I'm not ready to talk about it. And then after I got home back to Canada, as we were writing the narration, to fill in the gaps in the episodes of Ghost Cases, I became much more, I processed all the information and I became...
You calmed down a little bit. Right?
Yeah, I calmed down, that's for sure. But I became more comfortable with talking about it, but the not the shadow person thing. To this day, I'd love to go back to Chesky Krumlov and take that walk again by myself through town. And on the other hand, I'm pretty sure I'll never do that because I'm still a very frightening, it was a very frightening experience for me at the time. So, and still, it sticks with me. What is it now? 3.5 years later, I can remember it as if it had happened just 5 minutes ago as I'm talking to you. So those are the kinds of experiences that take a guy who was, the last time I was on your show talking to you, and great fun I had was back in 2006.
That's right.
It was much
that
more,
was a long time ago, Paul.
Yeah, much more skeptical than I am, than I am now. And the thing that changed that is, buying that ticket, going into the show, experiencing things yourself, opening yourself up to what might happen, and that alters your perceptions, not only of the universe around you and of the possibilities, but also it in a very real way, it altered how how I feel about myself and my own life. It made me rethink my own place in the universe. And I came out of that, George, just sort of saying to myself, if there is this non-human intelligence, God or aliens or whatever you want to call them, more advanced than us, then I think that's what they're doing. They're trying to make us think about ourselves and to imagine a broader world, because that's the effect that it had on me. So that's sort of the prism that I look at it through. Maybe other people would look at it differently. But for me and for other people that I've talked to, that always seems to be the effect. They walk away, if they've had a genuinely profound experience, more open to the possibilities of what might be out there, but also more open to the possibilities of what might be inside us, and thinking much more about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. And it was a kind of a sort of a paradigm shifting moment, if you will, for me, that whole experience.
Let's get into synchronicities for a moment, Paul. You were mentioning, of course, the synchronicity of me doing that story on the cat named Holly and your friend named Holly and things like that. Have you come across other very bizarre synchronicities?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. There's a whole chapter in the book about this three-week period. I was in Los Angeles in 2011 in the summer. And day after, I was in O'Hare Airport. I'll just give you one, which was the first one that really kind of made me start to think, and then things just kept happening. And if you've ever traveled through O'Hare, and I'm sure you have, you know it's a huge airport. It's like a giant monster airport. And the other thing you would know is planes often get held over there because it's just so busy, weather, whatever. I had an 8-hour layover once. Well, when I was flying out to LA, I was stopping in Chicago, and I got held over, but my plane was early. So it's the worst of both cases. Your plane's early, and the plane that's going to be leaving is leaving late. So now you're sort of held over twice, if you will. So I get off the plane, and I'm in the B concourse, and I go to the boards to see, okay, well, where's my next flight going to be? And I'll just situate myself there, and then I'll, you know, sort of plan out what I'm going to do. And the flight's early. My flight isn't even up yet. So I go, oh, great. So I just sit down at random in a seat. And I say, fine, I'll watch some CNN and I'll listen to some music. And eventually I keep getting up to look at the board. And finally my flight shows up and it says, fine, your flight's going to be at gate B14. I look back and that's the gate that I'm sitting by. Of all the gates, it's like the Casablanca thing. Of all the girls or bars and, you know, wherever.
You're at that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Why did I find this one? So there, okay, that's a little weird. I sort of thought, well, this is a big airport. That's odd that that's the way that went down. Fine. So I remember that gate. I wander off. I get something to eat. I get some exercise. I walk through a couple other concourses that exhibit on flight. I watch that. Come back, sit back down, and I go, I think I need something to read on the plane. So, and my flight, you know, it's getting close to the time when the flight's you're supposed to be at your gate and boarding. So I say, I'm going to just walk down the hallway here to the Hudson News and get a copy of the New York Times. That'll tide me over until I get to L.A. Get down, buy the paper, walk out. And I hear on the public address system, the stewardesses, the flight attendant people, whatever, coming over to the flight, whatever number my flight was, from Chicago to Los Angeles, the gate has been changed. Okay. And they say, from gate B14, you're now at gate B6. I look over. I am literally standing next to the lady who is making the announcement. I'm at gate B6. I thought, okay, you know, this is just how did I wind up at these two different places at those particular times? There's no meaning. There's no inherent meaning that I can discern from that. I don't even look for one.
It's the great synchronicity. Paul, more to come. Plus, we'll take phone calls with you on the paranormal, the other side of truth, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.